slightly differs to mine. But for my discourse, mindful design is about understanding mental processes, understanding how our minds work, how the brain works, and treating those as inspiration rather than obstacles to overcome. You know, a lot of the times, especially with social media apps, you'll be looking at kind of like trying to, I guess, get people into a specific behavioral loop, or you'd be trying to convince people to use something the way it was designed or the way its creator intended. And for me, it's more about understanding certain concepts of the mind and really using that as a lens to evaluate our work and to evaluate it critically, but humanistically as well, and bring elements of humanism into something that has traditionally been, in my opinion, far too data-centric right now.
That was our guest today, Scott Riley. Scott is a designer, speaker, and author of the book Mindful Design, in which he outlines how people can integrate design processes with the understanding and appreciation the human mind deserves. His book is a deep dive into areas of cognitive psychology and neuroscience in ways that can most improve design. In this fascinating episode, Scott shares with us his perspective on why mindful design is essential to the creation of digital products, why design needs to take inspiration from brain structure, and the impact of operant conditioning on the products we use every day. But before we go ahead with that, welcome to Digital Mindfulness, a podcast which focuses on innovations in digital well-being, ethical technology, and responsible innovation. We're back after a small hiatus, and you'll get to hear insights from thought leaders around the world on these issues. In addition, join our webinars where we take a deep dive on key aspects of digital well-being. This month, we're looking at the continued evolution of the global meditation app market. You can find out more about this and the upcoming webinar schedule on digitalmindfulness.net. Okay, I hope you enjoy this show with Scott Riley. Scott, welcome to Digital Mindfulness. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you much more about your work and also your perspective on humane design. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to chat.
So, Scott, I wonder if you just give the audience an introduction to yourself and to your work. How did you come to be working in this area?
Introduction first. I'm Scott. I'm an independent designer, which basically just means I'm a freelancer and I pick and choose who I work with client-wise. I'm an author as well. As you mentioned, Mindful Design is my book. It was released last year, and that's kind of like the, I guess, not quite the magnum opus, right? But it's kind of like the main thing, that's a main career highlight so far. Really, to get to this point, it was a mixture of a failed career in games design. And by career, I mean like going to university to study it, dropping out halfway through and never actually designing a game in my life. And kind of just falling into tech, like from there, or very much in like an accidental horizontal move. And slowly just making the switch from developer to designer over probably 2 or 3 years of small projects and really just being frustrated at the things that I was developing, looking like shit, to be honest, not having like the visual stuff that I'd seen on other sites and stuff that other people were making. So kind of like self-taught, set out to learn the basics of design. And then just kind of typical, semi-privileged career through a couple of companies who hired me as a designer, kind of brushing up on the general design skills through there. But kind of like while all that was going on, I was suffering quite a lot with mental health issues. From a young age, I've always struggled with depression. And kind of towards the middle of my career, I guess, I was struggling a lot with pretty consistent anxiety. And kind of just spent time kind of really longer than I should have, putting two and two together and kind of seeing that okay, there's parts of the world, the digital world, that really feel like they're not made for me, that feel like, especially things like Twitter and stuff like that, where it demands a lot of attention and it locks you into these kind of like really tight feedback loops. I found myself like really struggling to break away from that. Whereas other people were like, take it or leave it with Twitter. I was very much like, oh, for some reason, I'm compelled to be on this hellscape of an app for 20 hours a day. And really kind of just in the, I guess, the desire to learn more about why was my brain like this? Why was I struggling and suffering the way I was? Started learning more about cognitive psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy. Just generally like a lot of the, I guess, the systems of the mind that might cause anxiety, you know, how anxiety might be a disruption somehow of the attentional system. And just things like that, through trying to understand what was going on in my own head through this, this feeling of not really being considered or feeling like I wasn't considered in the digital products specifically, kind of led to that exploration and kind of putting that together and realizing, okay, so personally, I think there's a problem with process in the design process. And that I think there's a problem with, attitudes in tech, specifically attitudes revolving around the attention economy, late stage capitalism and all that. And it was very much two very nebulous concepts. It's like, okay, what the hell is going on in my own head? What is causing this? And how is tech somehow a reflection of those bad things? And kind of the more I thought about that, the more I put those together, kind of the more, I guess, feasible this idea of a book became. So I put a introduction together for what I wanted the book to be, found a publisher who was willing to take it on. And then really it was just a case of, let's get this book written. Let's do the further research. Let's compile all this stuff that I'd read very casually and as trying to get an insight into my personal issues. Let's look more at the academic literature around that. Let's get away from the self-help books and more into, okay, well, the studies that those self-help books talk about, the baseline understandings of some of our mental systems. And let's look at that through a critical gaze of design's role in attention deficiencies, design's role in exploitation of mental processes and all that stuff. So there's a very natural, not really natural, but a very kind of long drawn out process to get all that information. And then very quickly, like, shit, let's write a book about this. So yeah, that's a very scattered journey to where we are now with the book released and me trying to implement it with clients.
You know, Scott, we're going to talk about the book in a lot more detail, but one thing I do want to pick up on, and this is mainly the main thread throughout the book, is the interrelationship between mental states or psychological processes and what we actually interact with in terms of our design. And you say that there's a very, very strong interrelationship between the two, and I want to really interrogate that a little bit more, because there is a growing chorus of people that say, actually, these mechanics that you're speaking about are really overblown, and their impacts on physical and psychological behaviors and well-being, it's overblown. So I'm wondering, on what side do you come with regards to that argument?
I think there's a couple of angles I would approach that on. I would disagree with it personally. And just based on the research that I've been doing and the personal and anecdotal, not so much evidence, but experiences that I have. The first one would be that in general, and I really hate the idea of the kind of the word neurotypical or neuroatypical, but if you are neurotypical, if you're you know, you're not prone to anxiety, if you're not really suffering with mental health issues, I think it's very easy to not so much overlook, but just not experience the effects that some technologies can have on people. I think for me, it's almost a matter of exclusion, and you know, exclusion of people who might have issues with anxiety, people who do not have what you would consider a typical pool of mental resources, right? People, and then that could be anything. That could be someone suffering from ADHD, someone suffering from anxiety, to someone being on the poverty line. All of those things, and it's very much those things are, you know, some of them are just stuff that happens to your brain and you have no control about it, and some of them are stuff that happens as a result of society and as a result of where society leaves on specifically underrepresented people. And I think a lot of that discourse erases those viewpoints a little bit. For the vast majority of people, or for the vast majority of neurotypical people, modern technology might be totally fine for them. And this idea of an attention economy might seem like bullshit. But at least for me and the people that I've spoke to and the people who are cognitively burdened and the people who do experience technology related burnout, it's a very real issue. And a lot of it is down to how things like Twitter, things like Facebook are designed. They're designed around compulsion habits. They're designed around what is essentially a trickle of content that is supposed to keep people, quote unquote, engaged for as long as possible, so they can serve more adverts. Like, that's just the business model of social media right now in late stage tech capitalism. So I feel like it might seem like it's being overblown, and it might seem like there's this kind of like lifestyle tech mindfulness profiteering going on, and people kind of overhyping for their own reasons. And I do think that there are certain examples where that might be the case, but I think in general there's a lot of underexplored areas of technology, and specifically how tech profits from certain behaviors that that contributes to that. So yeah, I think it's less of a, has a bunch of studies and has some empirical evidence on just how much tech is fucking us up, and more of a tech that is designed with exclusionary practices can manifest itself as detrimental to people who don't experience the world in ways that others do.
So Scott, everything that you've just described there has led you now to the writing of this book, which is called Mindful Design. And it would be great if you can just tell us exactly what mindful design is and why it's so important.
Yeah, so for the purpose of my discourse around it, like, I came up with this title without realizing that there's like genuinely a mindful design sub movement. So it's really confusing for me now, because there's this concept of mindful design that slightly differs to mine. But for my discourse, mindful design is about understanding mental processes, understanding how our minds work, how the brain works, and treating those as inspiration rather than obstacles to overcome. You know, a lot of the times, especially with social media apps, you'll be looking at kind of like trying to, I guess, get people into a specific behavioral loop, or you'd be trying to convince people to use something the way it was designed or the way its creator intended. And for me, it's more about understanding certain concepts of the mind and really using that as a lens to evaluate our work and to evaluate it critically, but humanistically as well, and bring elements of humanism into something that has traditionally been, in my opinion, far too data-centric right now. So very much just looking at how the mind works, but using that as as inspiration more than this is how to overcome it, this is how to exploit it. So that's kind of where I've settled on the definition. Pretty long-winded, but
so Scott, I'm thinking now for people that might push back on that definition, and they would say, for example, that when they're creating digital content or products, that they need data to be able to have some kind of accountability or yardstick to understand the performance of this thing that they're investing so heavily in. So I'm wondering now, because you made mention of mindful design being a move away or an evolution away from having a data-centric approach to design. So what would you say to that kind of conflict between needing the data yardstick and actually implementing mindful design?
I fully understand that. And if I wouldn't have a career if I wasn't able to make the right numbers go up, which is part of tech. It's part of, again, I don't want to turn this into a massive radical socialist rant, but it's part of, you know, capitalism's hold on tech right now. And it's a heuristic for performance, right? And yes, there's economies around tech. There's economies around building a successful product. And a lot of that involves data. My point isn't specifically to eradicate data from the equation. It's to introduce more humanist approaches, seeing people as fallible human beings rather than numbers in a fucking mixed panel dashboard, right? Without seeing people as changing ephemeral entities rather than hard data in a spreadsheet. So it's more to me about the juxtaposition and the idea that experienced and observed diverse behaviors should always override numerical averages. Keep data, use data as an insight, but before you make any decision based on data, do the ethnographic research, do the workshops, challenge those ideas from diverse perspectives, and don't just rely on data. Data is really easy to set up. It's really, especially if you have a pretty high traffic product or a well-trodden product, it can provide multiple areas of insight. But when you start relying on data, or when you abstract humanity into numbers, that to me is when you start getting issues that Twitter has got right now, where it's extremely difficult to justify making an impactful change to a product like Twitter because of the metrics that they use to essentially see how profitable they are, see how feasible they are as a company, right? Like, they are so, and I've worked on so many products that are so entrenched in the data that it's extremely difficult to make meaningful positive changes because there's that fear of, oh, what if we shake up this data? And it is rooted in many layers, a corporation, right up to the exec level and the investment level, where a lot of decisions are made purely based on numbers. And if something makes a number go up, it's good. And if something makes a number go down, it's bad, or vice versa, right? So use the data, use it to provide preliminary insights, hypothesize based on data if you want to, but please don't make decisions without exploring the humanist side of things, the ethnographic research, the workshops, all that kind of stuff.
You know, Scott, one of the things that you mentioned previously was that, you know, technology, the technology that exists at the moment, a lot of it profits from certain behaviors, and that some tech is designed with exclusionary practices. And I'm wondering if we can talk about that in the context, particularly of attention and distraction, which is your first chapter. How does that work then, particularly with attention?
I think understanding what distracts us and understanding the imperatives behind distraction and how the attentional system works. So we are not so much designed as humans, but it's in our nature as humans. Our attentional system works in a certain way where we are quite easily distracted. And you know, whether that's a startle impulse, whether that's an emotional distraction. There are things that, whether it's through how they stand out or whether it's through creating a supposedly serene experience and then interrupting that at certain times, that relies on kind of this evolutionary imperative to be distracted, which generally from the research I've done looks to be one of those things where we spent a lot of time running away from shit that wanted to eat our face. So when we're out kind of hunting and gathering and all that stuff, we needed to be alerted to sounds and sights and movement. So we didn't get our face eaten off by a lion or a bear or anything like that. And that imperative is still within us. We still have this startled reflex within us. And we are distractible by nature. And I think as well, kind of like a lot of old school designs relied on that, especially kind of like back when you couldn't move on the internet for pop-up ads, right? And back when, you know, even a few years ago when autoplay and video was a thing, these are all things that not so much hijacked our attentional system, because I think that's a bit strong of a word, but very much like relied on our startle reflex and our ability to be distracted to bring our attention to something else and distract us from the task at hand. I think as well, it's really, really difficult to talk about attention without talking about kind of motivation and compulsion as well. So kind of like a lot of the, it's such a cliched phrase and I've used it a bunch and I know tons of people have, and but the idea of like, oh, a little boost of dopamine or whatever, you know, when we check our Twitter and we've got notifications and stuff like that. And that's really the interplay between how we are compelled to do something, not necessarily motivated, which a lot of the discourse around motivation, especially in design, is actually compulsion discourse rather than motivation. But if you want to talk about that, we can. But really, it's kind of like, it's about getting our attention onto something specific, you know, whether that's through a notification, whether that's through a pop-up, whether that's through the noise that our phone makes to let us know that something has happened. And then there's a more insidious, once you have the attention, essentially, a more insidious process, which is kind of where the compulsion comes in, which is all about making that thing feel rewarding, but not rewarding enough that you're satiated, so you want to do that thing again. And then it's kind of like, you know, that behavioral loop, which I think people really latch onto a lot in the attention discourse, especially around digital products. And I'm sure that's something that you've probably covered multiple times from multiple different angles, but really it's kind of that basic conditioning theory, really, that people seem to have picked up on and glamorized and worked into their digital products. And you know, you see it on things like Twitter, you see it on anything that's gamified in any way, relies on that kind of like extrinsic motivation, and that pattern of really, I guess, compulsion. And it's not as harmful as a compulsion that, it's not the most harmful compulsion that could exist, but it's still based around classical conditioning, operant conditioning, whatever you want to call it. Just this idea of motivation, compulsion. So I think the attention side of things is actually quite a bit simpler. Basically, if you make a big enough noise in a serene enough environment, people will notice it. And it's about whether, you know, the distraction justifies the mental energy. I think for me, the insidious side comes from what people do once they have that attention and how people kind of try and create that compulsion around it. Like, attention is the trigger point. Attention is like the, yo, look at this. And then the more insidious stuff comes in where it's like, isn't this thing great? Don't you want to see more of this? Don't you want to repeat this behavior? So yeah, I guess that's kind of my take on it. It's two discrete things, really, the compulsion side and the attention side.
And you've used Twitter a couple of times in your example, Scott, but Twitter is not an example of a serene environment. So the amount of attention that you would need to generate there would be absolutely colossal.
Yeah. And I think, again, something like Twitter or any kind of social media generally relies on like notifications. Notifications are the, I think right now, the de facto example of attentional manipulation. I think it's why the one of the most recommended things, whether you're a digital mindfulness kind of advocate, whether you're a mental health advocate, one of the like the first things someone recommends, turn notifications off. I think that yeah, they are the de facto because they disrupt your actual environment, right? Like if you get a notification on Twitter and you're already on the website and you don't have notifications on your phone, you don't have notifications on your desktop, it's really just a blue badge with a number in it. And you know, it's still distracting in the sense that it uses, it basically makes a contrast with the other icons because it's got a big blue badge on it and the other icons don't. Like, cool, you will notice that more than the other icons, but that's not so much a really aggressive way of notifying someone within a product. The real distraction comes from the device, right? And the way the device is set up or the way the product and the device interact to give you that notification.
So to that extent, you would be saying that people can design their devices or their digitized environments mindfully so that they can minimize all of these different elements of distraction, whether they be notifications or other things.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's a lot of, I don't want to be too disparaging about things, but like life hacky bullshit that revolves around like design your day, design your work day, design your relationship with your phone and all that stuff. And I think being aware of why that's something that you should do and what products, digital products might do with those notifications, I think is a big part of that as well. So I think, yeah, designing your experience is good, but also hold products accountable for the types of notifications they send. Some of the notifications you get, I keep notifications off. My phone is permanently on Do Not Disturb and I'll check periodically. I check my emails like twice a day. I check Twitter like 400 times a day and it's still an issue and it hasn't fixed my absolutely toxic relationship with Twitter at all, but I don't get notifications, and specifically because some of the notifications I get from certain products are the biggest load of bullshit you will ever see in your life. Stuff like marketing campaigns delivered via push notification, like that's that you should delete any app that does that. Like that is such a disrespectful way to take away someone's attention. You know, it costs mental resources. Sounds stupid because it's just, sorry, it sounds silly because it's just one ding, one slight distraction in your day. But if I'm being taken away from a task at hand, or if I'm being taken away from good old fashioned doing fuck all time by a ding, and that ding is Deliveroo telling me that I can get 10% off if I spend more than £15 on pizza today. Like that to me is a violation of what I've allowed this product to do in my life. And it does sound hyperbolic. It does sound, you know, really, really exaggerated. But when you enable notifications for a specific app, you are essentially inviting that app into your headspace. You're inviting that app, you're giving it permission to disrupt you and distract you. And I think the way many apps use notifications these days is bullshit, really, and it should really be challenged.
Scott, you're absolutely right. And certainly for my part, I can't express how much dissatisfaction I feel when when I get these texts or I get these, you know, I absolutely do suffer from notification fatigue, because it's impossible to know when it does go off outside of my peripheral vision whether these notifications are important or not, and invariably they're not. But in the book, you do talk at length about what happens at a neurological basis when we start to get all of these notifications and all of these distractions that do come to us from digital services. And I wonder if you can share with the audience a little bit more what is actually going on at that level, at the neurological level, when we do become distracted by these different artifacts.
From a kind of, I guess, a cognitive perspective, a notification is a purposefully distracting thing. So the first thing that generally will happen when we receive a notification is our attention will be taken away from whatever we were doing at that point in time. And if we weren't doing anything, there's a whole set of discourses around the default mode network and our brain's resting state and how important uninterrupted awake resting states are to us. So we're either doing something that we deem as important because we have, you know, set our mind to doing something, or we are getting some very important kind of relaxation time and mental meandering. So the first thing that a notification will do is it will disrupt us away from that thing, whether that's something we are doing or whether that's the absence of anything to do. So kind of through sound, through haptic feedback, via vibrations, and a lot of times through visual feedback as well. If it's a push notification coming on your phone while you are doing something productive on your phone, if that's possible. It's a very strong visual distraction as well. Like, the notifications are designed to distract. That can be good or that can be bad. And then once our attention is taken away from that, we are essentially potentially in a task positive state, which means that there's work to be done. There's something I need to do. If the notification is useful, then the distraction is welcomed. And we may address the notification, or we may just feel like, oh, cool, that's good to know. So if it's a text message saying your flight is delayed, right? That's important information. You were chilling in the airport, writing, I don't know, half a chapter of your book because you got there super early. You get a message that distracts you from your writing that tells you, yo, you've got 2 extra hours to work on this. You know, that reframes the task you were doing. It's a useful notification. If, which happens to me more often than not, it's a pointless notification, then you expend mental energy not only checking the notification. When we are distracted, it's very easy for us to kind of, I guess, or it's very difficult for us to get back to what we were initially doing straight away. Some people are better than it at others. Some people are, some people have ADHD. Some people have issues with their attentional system where it's actually really hard for them to get back to what they were doing. So every switch of attention in that chain costs mental energy. The glucose stores in the brain are being depleted as it's happening. And the more we switch attention, the more mental resources we use until, you know, we get to the end of the day or the end of the week and we have nothing left to give mentally because we've been so distracted and so all over the place with what we were trying to do. So it's a really kind of naive baseline level of what's happening with our mental resources and our mental systems through that kind of distraction imperative.
So going from that then, Scott, I've got a couple of questions. And the first is, as awareness of bad design, as you've just outlined, becomes much more pervasive, do you think that it's going to become prohibitive for companies to design products and services in this way? And the second question I have is, why is it useful for companies to use the brain's natural structures as inspiration for design? rather than just simply for, you know, simply than for gaming and profiting from the brain structures?
Two really good questions. So firstly, is it going to challenge people who currently design like this? I absolutely hope it does. And I think within the design industry now, there is a push towards more kind of systemic thinking. And I think if we see notifications as part of our system and something that should be designed and controlled and have principles attached to it that fall under an overarching design system, which is essentially a, without going into too much detail because it's such an interesting topic and there's so many people who can talk about it better than me, but a design system, part of that involves principles and how set things are used. So you might have like a notification badge as part of your design system, but then you would also say, this is when you should use it. This is the level of impact this thing should have. And I think as we think more systemically as designers, the idea that we can bring principles around things like notifications, things like transactional and marketing emails, and as well things like real world impact and social impact within our principles, not only as designers, but, you know, under a company or a product as a whole. So I think there's a challenge for it. It absolutely should get people to stop designing like this, because to me, it's exploitative design. It latches on to primitive mental processes that we can't control as much as we can control, as much as I can control if I wake up fucking depressed tomorrow, right? Like it taps into something that is very difficult for us to keep track of, or very difficult for us to realize when we are using mental energy up in that way. So that to me should be treated with a lot of caution, but at the same time, this systemic thinking in design, I think, is bringing the idea of principles and system-wide principles to the forefront, which I think is a really, really good movement right now. So that answers the first question. Can you repeat the second one? Sorry.
Sure. So the book is really a call for people to design for humans the way human beings actually are. And I'd just love you to talk about why it's so important, not just from an ethical perspective, but why it's also useful for the technology sector as a whole and our digitized society for products to be designed in this way.
Yeah, so I think for me, a lot of the discourse around kind of mental processes in design is quite negative and quite... let me try and figure the right word to use. It's quite protective. So, and I think I do think that comes from a good place. I speak a lot about how our mental processes can get exploited. But I think as well, there's the certain things we do as humans, the certain ways our brains work that are actually really fucking cool. And they make us really interesting, and they make us really kind of unique as a collaborative information sharing species, and you know, we do a lot of shit wrong, and we do a lot of stuff in society, especially Western society. We exclude a lot of people. There's a whole history of stuff that humans have done that has just been absolutely unforgivable. But when we look at kind of how we can help each other, how we can enhance the good parts of humanity, a lot of that I feel is in the way our brains work. The idea that we get stuff that's in our brain and we put it out into the real world somehow, like that to me is ridiculous as an evolutionary imperative. The fact that we want and need to teach through generations is huge. That's so interesting to me, this need to create. And you know, we've created now with tech in the digital world so many different ways to communicate, so many different ways to take what's in our brain and distribute it. And a lot of it is fucking terrible, right? A lot of it is abuse online. A lot of it is manipulation of systems and stuff like that. And I would argue that that is as much a failing of the people who created that product and the people who let that exist as it is the people who use those products to disseminate their bullshit. But trying to look positively on humans as an information sharing species, there's so much that we've done in terms of kind of creating new ways to write, creating new ways to mark up data, assistive technologies for people who, you know, are visually impaired to be able to consume stuff that they never had access to before, or that they wouldn't have had very easy access to unless they could go to a library and get something, you know, as a braille book, for example. Just things like that, where we are to a degree democratizing access to information. A lot of that is still work in progress, but that gives me hope. The fact that the internet in its early days was all about linking together and democratizing access to content, that is one thing for me where it's like that's used our innate desire and what appears to be a need as a species to educate and disseminate content, and even just freeing up our own brains from having to remember stuff by putting it out there. Note-taking apps would fill in with this as a personal thing. The ability to, I mean, we've, for God knows how long, we've been able to write shit down, but being able to like quickly write down something that was in your head and having that sync to the cloud and being able to reference that at any point in time, like that to me is an extension of pen and paper, which unto itself was an extension of whatever shit was knocking around in our brain. So that's really cool. Looking at the attentional system as well and understanding that when we're focused on something, our ability to blare our periphery and just let shit exist in our periphery that isn't super distracting. Generally, if we're in an environment and say I'm in a coffee shop and I'm looking at my laptop screen, I'm focused for maybe 20 minutes, an hour, but I am focused. I have the ability to look at my laptop screen and select out all the other stimuli that's going on around me, whether that's visual stimuli, whether that's movements, whether that's conversations on another table if I don't have headphones in, for example. And that to me is incredible. We are able, our brains are able to filter out unimportant stuff. And the example I use in my book is focus mode in IA Writer, which essentially does what the attentional system does within a product. So if you enable focus mode, the paragraph that you are working on is high contrast, it's black on white or white on black, and all the other paragraphs are low contrast, they're really light gray or really really dark gray, depending on whether you're in light or dark mode, and they're essentially just blurred into the background. So you're basically mimicking the attention process there, and that kind of, that's part of what I mean by kind of using the brain and the mind as inspiration. So if you inspect the systems that make us behave in certain ways or make us susceptible to certain things, behind that as well, there's a lot of positives to it. And if we digged a bit deeper, instead of thinking about, you know, this immediate desire to either protect or to exploit, you'll see there's a lot of good and a lot of super interests and ideas just literally knocking around our brains, right?
So Scott, for the people listening to this show, and in particular the designers who might be thinking, okay, everything you said is great, how now do I start to design more mindfully? What are the first things that you would advise them to do?
I would try and sell them my book as a starting point, because as much as I hate capitalism, I still need my book sales, right? So after that, I would say, really, a lot of it comes from making sure that ideas stand up or change in the face of diverse challenges. And essentially, that boils down to a statement that I make quite a lot, and that's the people who you design for and the well, essentially, yeah, the people you design for are, and who you choose to include in your design process, who you choose to include in your research, are as big, if not bigger, a statement about your values, about the values of the thing you're creating, as the way you design it, as the way it's built, as the idea itself. So if you are not looking at ways that your product can be misused, if you're testing it on a bunch of white dudes, if you are building it as a bunch of white dudes and you are not putting it through a diverse range of employees and paid research participants, then you are going to create a naive product. Naive products can be exploited themselves. They can be used to further oppression. They can be used to empower the wrong people. So the who you empower with your work, and that's based on the assumption that design and technology can empower, which I do believe is true, but who you choose to empower with that is as much of a statement as the thing you're creating itself. So really kind of, and if you don't know who your thing empowers, it probably just extends the status quo. If you haven't done the groundwork, specifically if you are designing from a position of relative privilege, if you haven't done the groundwork and included the right people from day one and paid those people fairly and everything that comes with proper inclusionary processes, then you are fucking up at the first step. So that's kind of like the first thing I would point out, is you need to understand the real world impact of the thing you're creating. The thing you're creating is based, I'm assuming, if it's a commercial product, it's based on the idea that it will in some way empower someone, and introspect who that empowers and whether those, like, that group of people needs to be further empowered. I think that would be the biggest thing for me, is like early days, put an idea before it's a wireframe, before it's a prototype, before it's a version one of your app, put an idea itself through its paces. And that doesn't just mean sitting with your boss or sitting with your other extremely rich white investor friend and hashing out some cool ideas. It means looking at how your idea can be misused. It means putting it through its paces in terms of who it will impact, what the real world impact, what the potential social impact is. And if you're coming short on any of those answers, then you need to do more work. I think that applies more to, I guess, commercial design. It applies more to people with ideas that their product is going to reach millions of people. I think as well, just in terms of approaches to design, because that is a very wishy-washy statement, right? In terms of approaches to design, think more systemically. Think about design as a translation of a system. And through looking at the system, looking at a product as a system, and thinking about how you can translate that to simplify it, I think there's a lot of value in that. There's a lot of value in systems thinking around design. Read as many books as possible on systems thinking. Some of Donella Meadows' books, for example. And start to understand that, okay, this thing I'm designing, this system that I am abstracting, which is, to me, that's what design is, or a huge part of design, is looking at a system and saying, you know, how can I abstract this really complex thing that works in this really idiosyncratic way? And how can I make it so some random person can come up and interact with that system without needing to speak that system's language? You know, computers, for example, operating systems on computers are perfect examples of that. The shit that goes on inside a computer, I don't know how it works. And I studied it for 3 years, right? But operating systems are great abstractions of that. Files live in folders. That is a high-level abstraction of data storage, and it's intuitive, and it's stuck around for decades. So things like that come from understanding a system and understanding the mental models and the metaphors and the signifiers that you can use to simplify that system. And with those skills, you can simplify and analyze the systems that your product will exist in as well, which, you know, think about the society that you'll be putting this thing out into. If you want to think about that as a system, you can, or the systems that make that society exist. If you want to approach it as the company as a system, if you're working on a enterprise level software, think about how companies might work as systems and abstract them out. And you know, there's a lot of, to me, there's a lot of value in that kind of like introspection of a system and the ability to abstract it out so people can interact with it without needing to speak its language. So read a shitload about that is another kind of point I would make.
That's great. Like, there's a ton of reading people have got to do. So Scott, penultimate question. Given all of the work and research that you've done around this space, what would you say is the future for mindful design?
To me, it's a concept called self-determination theory. And that's essentially the idea that, so when I was talking earlier and I was meandering and rabbling on about compulsion, and how people often confuse compulsion with motivation, and a lot of the motivation discourse to me is actually compulsion discourse. What design and technology use, or at least the theories and the models that they use for motivation, which is where you'll get the whole kind of dopamine squirt discussions, you'll get the whole like feedback loop. Tristan Harris talks about slot machines and all that kind of stuff. It's essentially the idea that we can be compelled to do something based on a series of based on the right series of prompts and responses. So a notification that you have new mentions on Twitter has you checking Twitter, maybe has you replying to it, you using the app, then it has you back on the timeline. You're looking at adverts and you're looking at probably some bullshit white supremacy, and you are interacting with all the shit that's on there, and that's your usage cycle. And, you know, quite naively, that is essentially a compulsion model based on classical conditioning from like Pavlovian days, where he like fucked around with his dog. And operant conditioning from B.F. Skinner days, where he like electrocuted pigeons and shit. So it's all very ethical and very, as you can see, modern. But it's the idea that kind of there's an alternative theory behind it all, and that is self-determination theory. And that looks at intrinsic motivation, and it looks at what compels us to do stuff without these external impulses, without these notifications, without this attempt to hijack or direct or get us to use something in a specific way or follow a specific set of prompts and end up at the what a designer or a developer or a CEO or an investor has deemed the right place. So self-determination theory like kind of eschews all that. It's not a like classical condition and operant condition are proven things. It's just whether they are ethically implemented or not. 99% of the time they're not, and I will stand up and say that any discourse around classical or operant conditioning in technology is damaging and dangerous and has set us back 10 to 15 years in terms of the discourse of cognitive science and psychology and tech. So I'm not the biggest fan. So I'm kind of biased in that there's this alternative theory around motivation, specifically intrinsic motivation, called self-determination theory, which basically says that anything we are motivated to do something, and we might find pleasure in doing things that give us a feeling of three different things, and that is competence, autonomy, and relatedness. So the idea is, and this is kind of where my understanding of humanism intersects with my understanding of technology, in that there's so many apps that would be so different and potentially so more intrinsically rewarding if they weren't based on this operant conditioning bullshit, and they were more introspective on self-determination theory. So the idea of competence, being able to show that you're good at something without any other external motivations, without kind of feeling like, oh, if I'm good at this, I'll get paid for it or anything like that. Just purely through the idea of being able to display to yourself or to others that you are good at something. How different would the things we design be if that was a KPI, a key performance indicator that people get judged on at companies to see if they should be fired or given a raise or some other bullshit? If the ability to inspire feelings of competence was somehow a KPI, and we moved away from data, we looked at things more humanistically, and we were able to say, cool, let's find a way to see if we are actually inspiring that feeling of competence in other human beings. How different would set things be? How different would, a writing app be if that was the focal point? Again, autonomy. How in control do we feel about the things that we're doing right now within a specific system, within our day-to-day actions and within ourselves as a whole? Like, how in control do we feel about a task we're about to perform or a task we're currently performing? Again, how different would the products that we use every day be if autonomy was a big focus? You know, I would argue that we eschew autonomy far too much, especially in design. We want people to follow stuff. We use things called user journeys, which is essentially a linear map of person does A, person does B, person does C, person does D. And it's very linear. There's no sense of autonomy. It's very controlled and constrained. And, you know, a big kind of part of my thinking and something that I wonder a lot about is if we treated design and the things we created as environments where shit can happen, and we didn't try and be so prescriptive about the order that stuff happens in or the conditions you have to meet for a thing to happen, if we were a lot less linear with what we were doing, you know, how different, how more intrinsically motivating is the stuff that we can create? How, you know, how much more motivating would that be? How much nicer to use would that be? And relatedness, feeling a sense of relation to other people, to things in our life, without really kind of latching onto that rampant consumerism idea of relatedness or relationships, but, you know, that belonging that we find in a smaller community, that exposure to other people's ideas and feeling welcomed and all that stuff fits into it too. So like, how different would a social media app, for example, be if its main performance indicator was about relatedness and about bringing people together in a way that doesn't revolve around like rampant cycles of mass content production. So for me, and I know that's a really long-winded answer, but for me, it's about embracing that theory. And it's about thinking more from a more humanist perspective. And I think for me, that's kind of the utopia for me in terms of design, is that we shift almost everything we do to embracing that theory and to really just moving away from exploitation, moving away from extrinsic motivators, and moving more towards this empowering people through intrinsic motivation, understanding that there's these things that sound very romantic and sound very wishy-washy that you can observe in people using your thing, and the feeling you get when you see someone kind of motivated purely by what they can do in the thing you've created, that to me is what design is all about now. And it's so much nicer than your boss coming over and saying, yo, this thing went up by 4%. You've done good. So proud. So yeah, that's it for me. Self-determination theory becomes the de facto thing we judge our work against.
Thanks so much for that, Scott. I think that's a really great place to end it today. So where can people find out more about you and your work and buy your book?
As I said, I'm on Twitter far too much. My tweets are protected in an attempt to kind of not use it as much. But if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Scott_Riley. And my personal website, where I'm trying to move a lot more of my writing, do a lot more blogging, is scott.is. So scott.is. And they're pretty much the two places I'd say. If you want to read more of my ramblings, go to my personal site. If you want to connect, my Twitter DMs are open, even though my account's protected. So yeah, if you wanted to connect there, that's fine. I don't check emails very often, so don't email me. It's for terrible people.
Well, Scott, look, thanks so much for sharing your time and sharing your wisdom with us. Mindful design is really fantastic, and I wish you all the best with it, because it's something definitely that everybody should read. So thank you once again for spending time with us.